Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Mito Action's monthly expert series. Today, Dr. Mary Kay Koenig, who serves as the director of the Center for Treatment of Pediatric Neurodegenerative Disease and director of research for the Division of Child and Adolescent Neurology, and the associate vice chair of clinical research at the University of Texas McGovern Medical School, has joined us to discuss expanded access and compassionate use of experimental therapies. My name is Stephanie Harry. I'm one of the patient support coordinators at Mito Action and will be your host for today. Today's presentation will be recorded and available on Mito Action's website in the upcoming days, as well as on our podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spotify. We encourage you to ask questions throughout the presentation using the Q&A feature on the bottom menu bar of your screen. If you're calling in via phone, feel free to submit your questions to us by email at info@mitoaction.org. We will do our best to get through as many questions as possible at the end of today's presentation. Expanded access and compassionate use are terms that are utilized in our rare disease community, but what do they mean? How do patients learn about, get involved, better understand the qualifications, and talk with their providers about participation in either of these programs? We are glad that you're joining us today as we dive deep into better understanding the differences and overlap between expanded access and compassionate use therapies. Dr. Mary Kay Koenig serves as the director of the Center for Treatment of Pediatric Neurodegenerative Disease, director of research of the Division of Child and Adolescent Neurology, and associate vice chair for clinical research at the University of Texas McGovern Medical School. Dr. Koenig attended the University of Texas in Austin, where she received a Bachelor of Arts in Biochemistry. Following undergraduate school, Dr. Koenig received a Master's of Science in Microbiology at Southwest Texas State Medicine. After medical school, Dr. Koenig completed a pediatric residency at the University of Texas Medical Branch in Galveston and a fellowship in child and adolescent neurology at the University of Texas Medical School. Upon completion of her fellowship, she joined the faculty and is now a tenured professor. She served as the director of UT Mitochondrial Center of Excellence since 2007, the co-director for the UT Memorial Hermann Tuberous Sclerosis Clinic since 2007, and the Leigh Syndrome Clinic Director since 2013. Dr. Koenig strives to provide excellent clinic care and advanced research for children affected with genetic neurodegenerative disease. She also works to mentor and educate junior faculty, fellows, residents, and medical students in the art of medicine. In the art of medicine and clinical research. I love that, Dr. Koenig, that you put that, the art of medicine. And we really appreciate all that you do for our community and being here today and willingness to break these hard things down for us and just help us to better understand and share your expertise. So without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to you and looking forward to all that you have to share.
Thank you. Thanks so much, Stephanie, and thanks to Kyra. I really appreciate having this opportunity to talk with everybody and appreciate that Mito Action puts all this together. So thank you so much. All right. So today we're going to talk about expanded access and compassionate use of experimental therapies. And in order to do that, I really think we need to understand the drug development process. And so I'm actually going to start this talk a little bit by kind of breaking down the whole process of drug development and how we get to bringing a drug to patient use. So we're going to start with well, the goals of this talk really are to understand what the terms expanded access and compassionate use mean as they're used in relation to rare disease drug therapy, and to learn how to get involved in or talk with your doctor about participation in one of these programs. And again, I want to make sure that that goal is clear. So we are going to talk about drug development. We're going to talk about how drugs start out and end up being tested. But the goal of this talk is really to understand how someone can get involved in an expanded access program if they're interested in doing so. So drug development actually consists of five very clear phases. The first one is called discovery and development. The second is preclinical research. The third is clinical research. And then there's a process of FDA review, followed by post-market safety monitoring. So the first phase, discovery and development. Before any drug can be developed or be used in patients, researchers have to discover what molecules play a role in a disease so that then they can find a target for a drug to produce a beneficial or therapeutic effect in. So, for example, if you look at this slide here, a healthy mitochondrial membrane has lots of different components to it. Any which of these components could potentially be a target for therapy. In a disease state, the mitochondria are no longer functioning properly, and the mitochondrial membrane has become disjointed. It's no longer curved appropriately. So any of these molecules here that are malfunctioning could become a target for disease therapy. So one of the things that has to happen, the first step in any drug development, is identifying what's wrong in the disease state so that you can then identify a target, something within the cell that you want to fix or correct, so that you can find a drug or a molecule to fix that at a cellular level. And that's the first step in drug development. The compounds that are able to interact then with this target become a drug candidate. And that candidate then has to be assessed. Is this something that you can make that can be absorbed into the body? Is it going to cause side effects if you give it to a patient? Is it going to interact with other medications? So this whole process can sometimes take up to 10 years, this drug development discovery phase of drug development. And once you start identifying these potential candidate therapies, once you've identified something that you have recognized is able to target the problem at a cellular level, you believe that it can be absorbed, that it's not going to have too many side effects, and it's not going to interact too much, then you're able to move on to phase two of drug development. Phase two is the preclinical stage. In the preclinical stage of drug development, researchers start doing in vitro and in vivo testing. So this is when they start testing their drug candidate in test tubes and in animal models. So the main purpose is now looking at pharmacodynamics, pharmacokinetics. How does this drug interact with the body in an animal model? So what happens to the drug when you inject it into an animal? Does it get dissolved very quickly? Does it get metabolized away? What does it do? Does it cause side effects to the animal? Is it absorbed appropriately the way you thought it would be? And most importantly, the main purpose is to assess whether or not it has the potential to cause serious harm to the animals. So you're looking at things like how stable is this molecule? How bioavailable is it? Which means that if we administer it to the animal via mouth, is it able to be absorbed into the bloodstream? And does it reach the target organ? So if we're trying to treat the heart, does it make it to the heart? And it allows you to investigate a variety of different ways of administering your medication. If your drug then passes through this phase and you feel like it is still potentially successful, it's reasonably safe, and you think that it is potentially going to be useful, then you can move on to phase three of drug development. Phase three of drug development is the clinical research phase. And the mainstay of this phase is clinical trials. And the clinical trial is when you begin testing the safety and efficacy of a drug therapy in people. So this is the first time you move into testing your therapy in people. So the clinical trial is a research study evaluating some type of medical intervention. Sometimes these are devices like a new heart valve, but what we're talking about today are drug therapies in people to determine is it safe and does it work. But before the clinical trial can begin, remember, you have to go through phase one and two. You have to do the discovery phase, and you have to do the preclinical models to determine that it has the potential to be effective and also the potential to be safe. So once you get into phase three of drug development, now you're in the clinical trials phase. This is where it gets confusing. You also have clinical trial phases. So these are different than the phases of drug development. And it's really confusing because they call them both phases. So now we're going to talk about clinical trial phases, which are all part of phase three of drug development. So there's three phases of clinical trials: phase one, phase two, phase three. In phase one clinical trials, you're evaluating safety. In phase two clinical trials, you're evaluating safety and dosing. And in phase three clinical trials, you're evaluating safety and efficacy. Following phase three clinical trials is generally when a drug goes to the FDA for review. So let's break these down a little bit more. And again, all of your clinical trials are part of phase three of drug development. Okay, so a phase one clinical trial. This is also called the first in human study. So this is the first time your novel therapy, your new drug, your drug that was just discovered and tested in preclinical models is given to a person. In standard drug development models, these are generally given to healthy volunteers. So these are not the people that you're trying to test the drug in. So in mitochondrial disease drug development, these would not be people with mitochondrial diseases. This would be a person who does not have the mitochondrial disease. The goal of this phase is really just to, one, make sure that this is safe, and two, to see what actually happens to the drug when it enters the human body. So, how much of the drug is absorbed? Does it reach your target tissue? And what is the most appropriate dose? So, how much can we give somebody before they start having side effects? So, you're checking the safety of it and trying to determine what the most appropriate dose would be. This generally doesn't involve a lot of people. It's usually a small number, a few dozen, and it doesn't take a very long time. Phase two clinical trials are the first trials generally given to people with the disease being tested. Usually, everyone will receive therapy. So, you take a small number of patients who have the disease you're testing and you provide them with the therapy. Everyone gets therapy. Everyone knows everyone's getting therapy. The primary goal of this phase is to assess the safety of the drug in your target patient population. So, you want to make sure that the people that are being treated and that you're going to be treated are able to tolerate the drug and that it's not going to do any harm to them. That's the primary goal of this phase of clinical trial. Now, while you're doing this, researchers will also assess efficacy. So they will also check to see if the drug works, but that is not the primary purpose of a phase two trial. Assuming that you make it through the phase two trials and everything seems to be safe, then the next phase of clinical trials is a phase three trial. This is a trial that involves a placebo. So a placebo is an inactive substance. It's a drug that, or a pill that looks just like the drug, but doesn't actually have the drug in it. It doesn't have any effect on the body. So the purpose of the phase three trial is to determine whether or not the drug works. Right. So phase one is your first in human. Let's make sure it's really going to be safe. Phase two is the first in people with the disease. Let's make sure it's going to be safe in the people who have the disease. And let's make sure we know exactly what dose we want to use. Phase three is where you're really trying to decide whether or not this drug works for the disease process that you're testing. Okay. At the same time, we're now enrolling more people. So we're going to also be assessing safety and monitoring for safety. So when you're doing the phase three trial, again, you really want to make sure that if you are seeing improvements in the patients, that what you're seeing is because of the therapy and not because the patient just believes they're getting better because they're excited about being on a treatment. And so this phase almost always involves the placebo. So what you do is you take your patient population and you divide them randomly into what's called an experimental group and a control group. The experimental group gets the drug, the control group doesn't. And you follow these two groups of patients for a period of time to see whether or not there's a difference in them. So did the experimental group get better and the standard group not get better? And what this does is it allows you to determine that the treatment is really what made people better. So one of the questions people had was, well, why would I enroll in a clinical trial if there's a 50% chance that I'm never going to get the therapy? And so one thing about phase three clinical trials is that they're often, and especially in rare diseases, not always, but often, followed by what's called an open label extension. So an open label extension is a phase of a clinical trial that occurs after the randomized portion. And in the open label extension, everyone who was on the trial is given the drug. Whether you were in the control group or you were in the experimental group, everyone gets the drug. And they get it for some specified period of time. So that kind of answers the question, why would you do a trial where there's a possibility you may end up in a placebo group or in a control group where you're not actually getting therapy? Well, if you're doing a trial where there's an open label extension, because you are going to get therapy once the trial is over. The other thing open label extensions do is it allows for long-term monitoring of safety. So if a trial is only 6 months long, but a side effect develops 9 or 10 months later, it allows the drug company to assess for side effects for longer term, which again can be beneficial. And it also allows to continue monitoring the treatment effects and make sure that this therapy does continue to work for a longer period of time. So the majority of trials in rare diseases are followed by open label extensions, not always, but often. Okay, so those are your clinical trial phases, phase one, two, and three, which again is all part of phase three of drug development. So let's assume you make it through your clinical trials, phase one, two, and three clinical trials, and you have positive results. You believe that your therapy is now effective and safe. Then you go to phase four of drug development, which is the FDA review. So if the trial works and you believe that the drug is safe and effective, then you send it to the FDA to review. And a team of FDA experts reviews all the data from the clinical trials and is who has the final decision about whether or not the drug receives, quote, approval. If the FDA approves the drug, then it is now available for a physician to write a prescription and you can go to your pharmacy and pick it up. If the FDA does not approve the drug, then it is no longer available or it is not available, still not available, and it's still in this experimental phase. Okay. Now, I will say for rare diseases, the FDA sometimes allows researchers to skip or even combine some of the phases of clinical trials. So for mitochondrial disease, you'll often see that phase one studies involve mitochondrial patients instead of healthy volunteers. The other things you'll see is that the phase one and two trials often get combined, and the phase two and three trials often get combined. Something else that is done a lot in people with rare diseases is that the placebo arm can be waived. That generally only happens for ultra rare diseases where there's less than a few hundred patients that we know of in the world, because we don't believe that there are enough people to enroll a placebo arm and have significant results occur. So generally, the placebo is the best type of trial to do, but with rare diseases and mitochondrial disease often falls in that category. There are exceptions to these one, two, three solid phases, and there are times when these phases overlap, get combined, and sometimes the placebo arm is not necessarily used. The other reason why a placebo arm would be excluded would be in a situation where we would consider it unethical to use a placebo arm. if it is a life-threatening condition and there is too much belief that the drug would work, then in that situation, we might waive a placebo arm because it wouldn't be ethical to deny someone treatment. Okay, so what happens if the drug gets approved? Well, if the drug gets approved, then there is a phase five to drug development. So just because the drug has been approved doesn't mean that the FDA or even the drug manufacturer stops. So what happens next is called post-market safety monitoring. This is also, to make it more confusing, called phase four of the clinical trials. So this is the phase five of drug development and phase four clinical trials. And this happens after a drug has been approved by the FDA. So the purpose of this phase is to continue long-term safety and efficacy monitoring. So there are some side effects that aren't recognized until a drug has been used for many years in a patient. And most clinical trials are short-term. They're only 6 months, maybe 12 months. And so if a side effect doesn't show up for 2 or 3 years, you won't pick that up in a clinical trial. You will pick that up in the post-market safety monitoring or the phase five clinical trial. And so this ongoing surveillance, it allows for detection and protects patients who are on therapies. So physicians, patients, drug companies, everyone has a responsibility to continue to report to the FDA if any new side effects, especially serious ones, develop in drugs post-market or once they're on the market. And what it does is it allows the FDA to continue to update the prescribing information, update physicians, and dose adjustments may occur even after drugs have been approved. As a physician, I can tell you we are constantly getting these updates from the FDA about drugs that are on the market. Okay, so now let's talk about the gist of what you guys want to hear about, which is expanded access and compassionate use. But again, I think that background is really important to understand how we get to expanded access and compassionate use and why there exists expanded access and compassionate use. The first thing to understand is that expanded access and compassionate use are the same thing. They are exactly the same thing. They are two terms used to mean the same thing. They're both terms that refer to a patient receiving an investigational drug that has not yet been approved by the FDA outside of a clinical trial protocol. Okay, so this is a drug that has been discovered and gone through preclinical discovery. So it's been through phase one and two of drug development. So it's already been discovered and it's already been through preclinical. We've already done the animal models for it and determined that it is reasonably safe. Typically in that stage, if a patient wanted access to this drug, the preferred next step would be for them to enroll in a clinical trial, phase three. But there are some situations where patients can't enroll in phase three. Those are the situations where a patient might be open or be eligible for expanded access or compassionate use. So when is that? You have to meet all of these criteria. The patient has this, and we're going to go through each of these criteria individually in more detail. Serious or life-threatening disease or condition. There is no other comparable or satisfactory treatment option. The patient is not eligible to enroll in a clinical trial. The potential benefits of the therapy outweigh the potential risks of receiving it. And the expanded access use will not interfere with the current clinical investigations that could support the ultimate approval of the product. So let's look at each of those in more detail. So what do we mean by a serious or life-threatening disease or condition? A life-threatening disease is a stage of the disease in which there is a reasonable likelihood that death will occur within a matter of months, or in which premature death is likely without early treatment. So either you believe that the patient is going to die soon, Or you believe that if you don't do something now, it's going to cause the patient to die before they should die. A serious disease is a disease or condition that has a substantial impact on a day-to-day function. This is where most patients are eligible to enter into expanded access. So, a substantial impact on day-to-day function. This is a disorder that prevents you from doing the things that you typically should be able to do in most days. So the key to these two conditions, severe and life-threatening, is that it's a matter of clinical judgment. What that means is that the physician determines whether or not they think a patient has a life-threatening or serious disease. There's not a specific finding, laboratory test, exam finding, diagnosis that a patient has to have. They're based on things like how long do you think the patient's going to survive? How do they do day to day? What's the likelihood that if we leave this disease untreated, it's going to continue to progress to something more serious? So a physician takes a whole lot of factors into consideration when they're trying to decide whether or not a condition is serious or life-threatening. I will say the majority of mitochondrial diseases, just by their nature, fall into this category. Not all of them, but the majority of them do. The second factor that you had to meet was that there is no comparable or satisfactory treatment. So the word comparable is defined as similar in size, amount, or quality to something else. Satisfactory is defined as good or good enough for a particular need or purpose. So, for something to be a comparable and satisfactory treatment option, there has to be another drug available that is similar and has a similar proposed mechanism and/or efficacy for treating the disease process. And the last time I checked, there are no treatment options for mitochondrial disease. So by definition, there is no comparable or satisfactory treatment in most patients with mitochondrial diseases. So that criteria is met for almost all patients with mitochondrial disease. And you are not eligible to enroll in a clinical study. So again, the preferred route is for a patient to enroll in a clinical study. But there are a lot of reasons why people are not eligible for clinical studies. So most clinical studies have very specific inclusion and exclusion criteria. Inclusion means these are things that allow you to be in the study, and exclusion means these are things that prevent you from being in a study. So these criteria are based on things like how old you are, your gender, your race, what your diagnosis is, your treatment history, other medical conditions. The purpose of these is to create a patient population with as little variation as possible so that when you're gathering the data from this clinical trial, you can be as certain as you can be that the information you get or any changes you see in your patients is based on the therapy and not something else. So, for example, let's say you had two patients with heart disease, and one of them has a no, let me start that over. Let's say you have two patients with mitochondrial disease, and one of them has heart disease and the other one doesn't. And you provide a therapy that you think is going to increase the ability to walk. And you give the therapy to both patients, and patient without the heart disease can walk further, but the patient with the heart disease can't. Well, it's very possible that the patient with the heart disease got better, their muscles got better, but they can't walk any better because they have heart disease, and that's what's preventing them from walking. So it doesn't do you any good to enroll this patient in the heart in the with heart disease in the clinical trial if you can't tell whether or not they got any better because their heart disease is impacting your ability to test the drug. So the exclusion criteria in particular are designed to prevent those we call them confounding factors, prevent those things that may impact your ability to tell whether or not the drug is working. Okay. It is not about making the therapy available to patients. A clinical trial is not designed to make therapy available to patients. It's designed to test whether or not a therapy works. And so I, over the years, have had many patients who have been disappointed that they were not eligible for a clinical trial because of one reason or another. They're not the right age. They had some condition that prevented them. They had the wrong genetic diagnosis. All of those things could potentially exclude you from being on a clinical trial. And again, the reason is because the clinical trial is not designed to give a patient therapy. The clinical trial is designed to test the drug. And so we need to make sure that when we're testing the drugs, we're doing it in the purest possible form so we get the best possible answer. But if you're excluded from the clinical trial because of one of those things, like you have heart disease or you have the wrong genetic diagnosis, that may be what makes you eligible for an expanded access program. So this not able to enroll in a clinical study criteria is what puts you in the potential expanded access category. And this may be one of the hardest criteria to meet for people because a lot of times patients are going to be eligible for a clinical trial. But if you're not, because you've been excluded for some reason, you don't meet the criteria for some reason, that really can solidly put you into the expanded access program criteria. The other thing is sometimes trials close and the trial closes and it's no longer enrolling. And then you can become eligible for an expanded access. Next is that the potential benefits have to outweigh the risks. I mean, I think that this makes sense to everyone. It's hard when you're a patient and you're trying to get access to a therapy that you think is going to help you. And you're able to, in your head, minimize the risks of this, which is why we bring in impartial people to try and help us understand what the risks and benefits of these therapies are. But the truth is, these are experimental therapies, and we don't know solidly what the benefits are or what the risks are. So we think we know what the benefits might be, and we think we know what the risks might be, but you have to weigh those and you have to say, well, what are the potential benefits and what are the potential risks? And do they balance in a way that benefits the patient? And so that is always a thought that is at the forefront when you're trying to decide whether or not someone should be eligible for an expanded access therapy. Lastly, the expanded access use won't interfere with current investigations. So there's two main ways that we think of that expanded access interferes with current investigations. So if there is an ongoing clinical trial, one of the things that can happen is that the drug company may only have a set amount of therapy. They may only have a set amount of drug. And if they give all of their drug to patients through expanded access, they may not have enough to do their clinical trial. And so if that's the case, then they can't give it to people for expanded access. They have to have it available for the clinical trial. Drug development costs a lot of money. On average, to take a drug from the discovery phase through FDA approval costs on average about $1 billion. It costs anywhere from $300 million to about $5 billion, but the average for a new drug is about $1 billion. It's really expensive. And part of that is manufacturing the therapy. And so they're not going to make a bunch of extra therapy, a bunch of extra drug. And so if they just don't have the product, they can't give it to you or give it to somebody or even sell it to somebody. And so if they don't have it, they can't give it. So if giving it to a patient for expanded access would make it not be available to the patients on the clinical trial, they can't do that. The other reason is that if patients were given a choice, most of them would choose to access therapy through expanded access. There's no placebo arm. Typically, there's not very many study-related procedures. And so if you just gave everybody a choice and said, either you could go through expanded access and you could just have the therapy, or you could enroll in a clinical trial, most people would do that. So patients who are eligible for clinical trials really are not going to be given the choice. And so if we let that happen, that would interfere with our ability to enroll in clinical trials. And that's another reason why it wouldn't be available that way, because then you're never going to know whether the therapy works or not. And I don't think anybody wants that. You don't want to be on a therapy for 20 years and not know whether or not it's actually working. Okay, so let's assume that you're eligible. So now let's talk about, how do you do it? What are the steps? And again, we're going to go through each of these. So the first step is you have to find a sponsoring physician. And then the sponsor, not the sponsoring physician, but the sponsor, this is the drug company, the person who owns the drug, they have to agree to provide the therapy. And then the FDA has to agree. And then something called an internal review board has to approve it. And then while the patient is receiving the therapy, they have to be regularly monitored by the sponsoring physician. So let's talk about the sponsoring physician. The sponsoring physician has to file all the paperwork with the FDA and the IRB, and they have to manage the patient's care and oversee their treatment and work with the pharmaceutical company the entire time the patient is on the expanded access therapy. And then they have to file reports to the FDA, the pharmaceutical company, and the IRB. And that is a very small amount of paperwork that that physician is buried under compared to the amount of paperwork that is required to do this for each and every patient. Most physicians don't know how to do this, and the amount of time it takes to do this is prohibitive. So in general, a physician who is not a researcher is not able to do this. A physician without resources is not able to do this. There's no reimbursement that comes with this. So most physicians who do this on their own time, because they don't get paid to do this in any way. Nobody pays them to do this. And again, I cannot underestimate or underexplain the amount of paperwork that is associated with this. It is a ridiculous amount of paperwork. These reports get filed and filed and filed and filed. So if you just go to your GP and ask them to sponsor this, they're not going to do it. They don't know how to do it. And the amount of time it would take them to try and figure it out is prohibitive. And then you have to get the company to agree. And it's important to know the provision of the therapy, it is at the discretion of the pharmaceutical company. They can say no for whatever reason they want. Two of the very common reasons they say no is, one, they just don't have the drug available. Like we said before, they may not have made enough of it. The other is that there is often a concern that that patients on expanded access may have side effects that could impact their ultimate approval. So let's say that a drug is finishing its phase three trials and it's done really well, and they're about to apply to the FDA for approval. And a patient who is very sick wants access to the therapy. And they're afraid that that patient who is very sick gets access to the therapy, might die. That would look really bad for their FDA application if someone who was taking the therapy died. And so they may just say no, because they don't want to have to explain to the FDA why someone taking the therapy died. And they have every right to do that. And they can do that. And so you just have to keep that in mind. It is at their discretion and they can say no if they want to. Okay, IRB review. So an IRB, an institutional review board, is a committee typically at an academic institution that reviews research involving people to ensure their safety, their rights, and their welfare. And technically, expanded access and compassionate use aren't research, but it's still important because there are significant risks associated with taking this kind of therapy, that patients are protected, and that there is an independent review of this process. And so therefore, all expanded access drug use is reviewed by an IRB before it is administered to a patient. And patients have to sign a consent form saying that they understand that this is not an approved therapy and they understand the risks associated with using that. And so again, that is just more paperwork for the sponsoring physician, but it is very important to ensure the protection of the people receiving the therapy. And then the FDA review. So in order to obtain this therapy from the pharmaceutical company and take it on an expanded access program, the FDA has to agree. So you have to submit this form. I don't have the number there, but a form to the FDA and ask their permission for the patients that you want to put on this expanded access therapy. And when the FDA reviews this, they look at the following things. They look at how serious the patient's condition is, whether or not there's any other available treatment options, whether or not there's a possibility for them to enroll in a clinical trial, and what the status is of drug development. So pretty much the same things we've been talking about and looking at already. And I actually looked this number up on the FDA's website. They approved 99% of single patient expanded access requests. So it's not like they're likely to deny you, but it is something that has to be done. And so it is just more steps that have to go through in order to get it done. So, and I think this is my last slide and then we can answer questions, but I get this a lot too. So I think when people talk about expanded access and compassionate use and what the difference is, keep in mind, there is no difference, but there is something called emergency use. And I think this is where people get confused. So emergency use is requested when someone is in a life-threatening situation and there is no treatment available. So I'm talking about someone who is in the ICU and they are going to die if we don't do something. And there is no time for all this paperwork because this paperwork can take months to get done. And we don't have time for that because this person's going to die if I don't do something. And that is available. And so that's something called emergency expanded access or emergency compassionate use. And I think people often get confused and think that that's what we mean by compassionate use, but that really is a different thing. That's emergency use or emergency compassionate use, emergency expanded access. So in this situation, so you have a patient who's in the intensive care unit, they're very sick, you think they're going to die, you need access to this therapy. It is solely the sponsoring physician's responsibility to determine whether or not this patient is eligible. Everything gets bypassed except you need the drug company's permission because they have to send you the drug and you need the FDA's approval. But you can bypass all the other stuff, and the FDA actually has a 24-hour hotline. And they will approve requests typically within 24 hours. I've had them approve them within hours. And so if you're in a situation where it's an emergency, you can do an emergency request and typically get approval within several hours. So it's the sponsoring physician who has to determine all the criteria. They have to initiate, typically starting with the drug company. So you call the drug company, you get approval from the drug company. And if they agree, then you call the FDA emergency number and you still have to submit the form to them, but they will do an immediate review And they'll notify you within a few hours. And then as soon as you can get the therapy, you may administer it. And then you submit all the rest of the paperwork, the IRB review, and all the rest of the formal paperwork for approval. And so typically that takes less than 24 hours. And so that is something that is available for patients who are in life-threatening situations. All right. My last slide shows you the long and winding road to get there, because sometimes it is a long and winding road. And there is a website through the FDA. It is a really good website that has a lot of information with a lot of very detailed steps on how to access expanded access therapies. I was telling Stephanie before we started, the easiest and best thing to do if you are interested and you know the drug that you're interested in is to start either by talking to your specialty physician or by going to the drug company. So if you just Google the name of the drug and expanded access, you can generally find a page that has a contact information for the drug company, and they'll put you in contact with someone who can talk to you about how to get access through their company. So thank you very much. I appreciate the time, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Dr. Koenig. If you want to go ahead and unshare your screen, I'm going to see if I can get the correct view here for us all.
I do not want to stop. Oh, there we go. Got it.
All right. Let's see. All right. This is amazing. I just really appreciate you taking the time because I think it really connected a lot of dots that we're kind of missing in our community as we're talking about expanded access and even the last part that you shared in regards to emergency expanded access and the difference between that. And there's questions that have filtered in a couple different places. And so, but I'm curious if you can start with talking because, like, you shared that expanded access is the same as compassionate use. Do you know when that language started to change and why did they start to change that language? No pressure, but it is interesting because some of our older families do use compassionate use, and that question does come up a lot as to it being the same or different, you know? And so I'm glad that you clarified that.
Yeah, I really don't know when or why or where the language changed from. In my opinion, it's not always just compassionate. We're not just trying to be nice to people. We're trying to help them because they deserve it. So you don't just do it because you're trying to be compassionate or nice. You're doing it because they deserve it. And so I like the term expanded better. That's my opinion, but I don't know exactly, no.
So, a patient asked who's international what the experiences are in sending drugs for expanded access abroad from the US to other trial locations. What does that look like? What have your experiences been with that? And how does the FDA like play into that? Because we saw, you know, all of those nice slides that you explained, like where the FDA's position is and everything. How does that work?
Yeah, that's a really great question. So I will say this was my presentation was very much geared to patients who live in the United States and to the United States regulations. So that is what I know, and that is the drug development path that I'm used to following. So I'm not really sure about the regulations for international patients. So my suggestion would be to reach out to the drug companies. I think that it is different for patients who live in other countries. Each country has their own regulatory body that is like the FDA, and they're going to have their own specific rules for how you access these therapies. So typically what you're going to need to do is start with the drug company. And then also I would suggest going to your own regulatory body. And finding information about their expanded access rules.
No, that's really helpful and a really great point. Because sometimes just as a patient community, like we don't know where to start, especially when we're in a different country and the idea that every country has different regulations. And so
Yeah.
it is helpful to start with a pharmaceutical company and then also understanding what the regulations are in your country, because they are so very different depending on the country. So another patient asked, Does the is the FDA okay? So this goes back to the clinical phase one. She asked, what does it mean that the FDA is already involved slash part of the research in clinical trial phase one? Does that mean that the FDA has an ethical board that specifically goes over therapies for rare diseases before waiving specific steps in the clinical trials?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, especially for rare diseases, the pharmaceutical companies are often able to meet with the FDA and talk to them about their clinical trial designs so that they can ensure that the clinical trial designs that they are performing are acceptable to the FDA. Because what you don't want to do is you don't want to ask patients to participate in a clinical trial that the FDA is later going to come back and say to you, "Oh, well, we didn't like the way you did that, so we want you to redo it." So in the old days, that's what would happen is people would do a clinical trial and the FDA would say, "Well, we didn't like the way you did that, so let's do another one and let's do it this way." So because especially working in the rare disease community, patients are valuable. Your time is valuable. We want to make sure that everything is done appropriately before we start. So the drug companies will almost always meet with the FDA before any of the trials are done, to ensure that everyone is in agreement about the trial design, and that the FDA is happy with the trial design before the trial ever starts. And that way, once the trial is completed, they're happy with the results if they're positive, and they're happy with the way it was designed. So, yes, they meet with them before.
Can you explain a little bit about like the comparators and end marks that are created like for the different trials? Like how do scientists create end marks and how does the FDA work with them on that
Oh, that's a whole
presentation?
lecture in and of itself. So we call them endpoints. So what do you decide is going to be the outcome? So how do you decide if a drug worked or not? And that is an entire science in and of itself, and it is often very difficult. And not always does the FDA agree with what the physicians think, who is not always agreeing with what the drug companies think. And so that is a big part of the preclinical trial meetings, is making sure that everyone agrees on the endpoints. Because you need to make sure that it's something that is meaningful to the patients and something that works and something that is measurable. And so it is often a very, very difficult task before a clinical trial is design is completed to decide what those endpoints should be. Yeah.
Can endpoints change once a trial started?
No.
No. Okay. So this goes a little bit to the endpoints too. Can you explain how natural history studies can be used as a comparator in trials?
Yeah, so that goes back to the ultra rare diseases. And it's always really hard to use a natural history study as a comparator group. So this is when you have an ultra rare disease and or a disease that is so severe that you don't think it is ethical to use a placebo group. In those situations, if you have really good natural history information, so for example, not going to name particular diseases or therapies today, but you have a disease, say, that produces very severe muscle weakness that leads to the need for respiratory support by the age of 12 to 24 months of age. If you have really good data that everyone who develops that disease needs respiratory support by the age of 24 months of age, and you are able to provide a therapy where no one needs respiratory support by 24 months of age, there are situations where the FDA will allow you to compare those two groups and say, "Well, clearly this treatment was effective because we have this comparator group. We know that before that treatment was administered, no one ever made it to 24 months." But in general, it has to be something that dramatic, where you are really altering a major medical outcome. And it has to be a disease that is generally what we call ultra rare, where it is very, very difficult to find patients to enroll.
So, a patient asked if you'd be able to give some insight into timelines. Like, what is the next step in timeline? Once a drug is approved by the FDA, that it can be approved for expanded access. But I'd like to expand the question if possible, just timelines in general. I know you can't give exact, but like sometimes I really appreciated how you kind of laid everything out and then you went through it step by step, because I feel like that showed just even naturally, like, wow, how much time each process can take. But if you could like share, like, oh, the first stage or phase can take like 3 to 5 years or 3 to 10 years, like, and how, so then how long does it take from a drug to go to development to market typically,
Yeah, so the average for a drug from discovery to market is about 15 years. The discovery phase tends to be the longest, usually closer to 10. Once a drug begins clinical trials, usually 4 to 5.
Okay. And then another patient asked, how can a patient know which drugs are already in clinical trial process?
Oh, that's a good question. I can give you that. So there's a website called clinicaltrials.gov. So literally just spell it out, clinical trials with an S on the end of it, .gov. And if you go to that website, you can put in the name of a disease like mitochondrial disease, or if you have a specific mitochondrial disease like Leigh syndrome, and you can search for all of the currently active clinical trials that are available. In order to have a clinical trial, it has to be registered on that website.
Then how would you know, like, based on that, like, let's say that the clinical trial has all the people that they need for that study. How do you know if there would be ability to have expanded access? Do you just have to contact that specific company to see if they're willing to do that? Or if a trial's
Yes.
closed, could you still just contact them? Or do they post that on clinicaltrials.gov if they've decided to engage in expanded access?
So, two things. One, I would suggest you talk to your physician about anything you find there, because your physicians are going to have a lot of knowledge about how to look at those things. But two, yes. So, anytime you go there, they'll bring up a list of trials, and each trial should have its stage. So, is it recruiting? Is it closed? Did it fail? Is it pre-enrollment? So sometimes they'll tell you before they start enrolling, but they also, if you click on them and go down, there'll be contact information. So it'll tell you things like what's the name of the therapy they're testing, who's the company that's producing the therapy. They'll tell you what the clinical sites are. You can contact any or all of those people, call all of them, email all of them until you get someone to answer you. And then if they don't answer you, maybe they're outdated, and Google them.
That's a good point, because I mean, it's hard to keep things up to date on the websites, and sometimes things aren't always up to date. So persistence, it sounds like, for sure. Okay, this next question is going to pull out some heartstrings, but I feel like you'll have a good response to it because of the kind of compassionate physician that you are. Sometimes when there's no opportunity for expanded access therapy and only palliative care remains, families can feel like that they're being given up on. What can we say or share to support family members who are facing these tough situations? I
That
know
is
it's
hard.
hard.
So I don't even know how to answer that. So I don't see palliative care as giving up. I think palliative care is a decision that's made to help your loved ones be comfortable and be happy and at peace with where they are. I'm a firm believer in fighting for as long as you want to fight. And I think that there's a time when people don't want to fight anymore. They just want to be done. And that's a different time for everybody. So I think that there's not a right or wrong time for that to be for anyone. And if there aren't any other options, and you still want to find one, then keep looking. And if one doctor tells you that there isn't one, then keep looking. But there has to be a point when it's just better to enjoy the time you have and be comfortable and happy, because it's not worth fighting anymore. And that's a different time for every family. And I think only you know when that time is right for you.
Well, I really appreciate you sharing that and diving into that, because I know that's a super hard question. And I know it's a question that many people in our community face. And it's a very different answer for each person, right? But as a physician, like, I know you see it as patient support people. We see it and walk through it. And as patients, you know, I think it's important questions that we ask ourselves and try to figure out answers to. So thank you so much for walking with us, MitoAction, but even more importantly, our patient community, as we ask these tough questions, seek understanding, and for your willingness to guide us and provide answers and break down some really important and hard questions. We really, really appreciate you taking the time today to explain to us about expanded access and compassionate use, and just even just the all of the all that goes into it before that stage, because you're right, it's very interconnected, and it is helpful to understand the bigger picture as we're seeking to better understand expanded access in general. So thank you so much, Dr. Koenig.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
If anybody has follow-up questions that we weren't able to touch base on, you can feel free to email me at sharry@mitoaction.org, and I'll try to make sure that those follow-up questions get to Dr. Koenig. Thank you so much for participating today, and we look forward to seeing everyone next month.
Thank you.
Bye.